We are in the 18th chapter of Revelation. I'm going to take liberty and go back and do a couple of recaps on 17. When you actually think about how the Bible's written, there were no chapters. And personally, I can't know this. This is a Lindaism. But I can't imagine that 17 and 18 were separated. They're all about Mystery Babylon. They're the two different parts of it that we studied. And I think modern writers that made the aggregate parts of all of the chapters and all thought that would be too much for the average mind to comprehend them together. But I really think they went together. Let's think about chapter 17 from last week. What we saw is Mystery Babylon, the religious system. Now, one thing I've learned about Revelation, and I hope I've imparted to you a little bit, is that things are exactly what they say. I am a literalist. You know that from the beginning of this study with me. But I am more than that. I'm a literalist deeper. And I don't know how any better to say that. It literally means that. I really believe there's a woman that had mystery written on her head and she was riding a beast. I believe that. I also believe it meant other things, and I believe it meant more, and I believe as you dig it means more, and I believe it means more, and I believe it goes to us. I believe we can take it all the way from tribulation pictures in John's mind in Daniel 600 years before, and Joel about the time of Daniel, and Malachi, and Ezekiel, and all those people seeing the same thing, and I think we can take all those pictures and believe they saw exactly that, and believe it is for the tribulation, and believe it means for me. I think it's just deep, 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 deeper, and deeper, and deeper. And the more I read, I was telling Alita before we started, this is not my first time to read this book. This is not my first time to study this book. This is a study I've done for 25 or more years I've studied Revelation. And what I found in this time is I didn't know very much. This time, whether it's like we talked about Daniel's unveiling happening, or whether it's the time period that we're in and the Holy Spirit is just pouring this discernment out on us, I don't know what it is, but I'm seeing new, fresh things. I think the Bible is like that. I think it says what it says. It means exactly that. It means deeper, and it means deeper. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not talking allegory. I don't believe this is an allegory. I think when we get into saying everything's a symbolism, we're way on a slippery slope, and that's not what I'm saying. I think it just means more and more and more. And so when I look at this religious system in chapter 17, and I see this harlot woman riding this beast, and she's adorned with the fineries of this world, and she has scarlet and purple and pearls and jewels, and she's drinking out of a golden cup, which is the blood of the saints, and she's fornicating with all of the kings, which I think are 10 demon kings, and she's riding the beast who's going to turn around and eat her up. I think she is the papal church, the papacy. Yes, I do think that. I think she's every other church that got left from the rapture. I think she's the Baptist church and the Episcopal church and the free whoever church and the televangelists and the money-driven feel-good churches. I think they're all that. I think they're wrapped up in this harlot, this fornicator, this persecutor of true Christians. I think it's the Islamic faith. I think it's every religion that gets wrapped up in this harlot of a person in chapter 17. And if I didn't do a very good job of explaining that last week, I want you to understand this. The mystery Babylon that we see is twofold. It is a religious system. Yes, it is all that. It's this world church, the one world religion we've heard all our life about. Then yes, it's the Catholics, and yes, it's Islam, and yes, it's the Baptists, and yes, it's the Episcopals. And yes, if you got left and you didn't get raptured and your pastor is standing on earth after the rapture, if he doesn't change his life, he will take the mark. And he will lead his congregation to hell. He will. Not my story. The earth dwellers are who this whole book is about. And many times we've had read over and over, they did not repent. Now, Could they? Absolutely. Yes, they could. They could ask Jesus in their heart. Probably they'd be beheaded. Would they be with Jesus? Yes. That's what our import is tonight. I believe we study, in fact, people say to me, why do you study Revelation? You're going to get raptured. I said, I know that. I study because of those that are not going to. And I'm trying to leave notes. I'm trying to leave books. I'm trying to witness to my lost friends and family so that they hear the words deep inside their psyche so that when we get taken out, they've got some base to remember. Because, guys, if they take the mark, they're doomed. We're seeing on this beast, this harlot woman, this fornicating, awful whore. And these are not my words. This is what God calls her. Calls her a whore. We see her, and she is the church on earth. I can't say it any plainer. Is it you? No. We've been raptured. We're the bride of Christ. We are the body of Christ. We're his chosen. We've been raptured. But what's left on earth that takes the mark, that rides the beast, that adorns itself in finery, that sucks on the blood of the saints, is the church of the earth. Get that straight. That's who you're seeing. Do I think it's the Catholic Church? Yes. Do I think it's every other church? I do. I think it's every other church that got left. Now, if I've made that clear, and I'm not sure that I did that last week, and I apologize for that, I want to go on and remind you of a couple of things that are review. In the 10th chapter of Revelation, John, this is the part that I think changed for me this study. John, Revelation 10:11. John was told to prophesy again. We've talked about this. So John, I believe, and this is not the study for tonight. I'm just going to review why I think he's one of the witnesses. This is old story for you, but you can go back to the 10th chapter of Revelation and pick that up. But I want to remind you that not only do I think he's one of the two witnesses, I think he's witnessing to us now. I think what he's telling us now is a witness to us. Look at this church. Are you part of one of these churches? Are you? Is your pastor not speaking the truth? I don't know. I don't know you, and I'm not pointing fingers. I'm telling you, this is John's words. Remember the very first chapter of Revelation. God gave this story to Jesus. Jesus told it to Gabriel, and Gabriel told John to write it down. It's that chain of command. And I'll tell you what, for me, if I'm going to get a message and it's going to go this way, God, Jesus, Gabriel, and John, I'm going to pay attention. And we're listening to John now prophesying again like he was told to in chapter 10. This is John saying, oh my gosh, look at this church. Do you know why John was so astonished in chapter 17? The word was a strange Greek word they used for astonished. It's almost like amazed. Not like the good kind of amazed. Like to me, I look at a hot fudge sundae with a lot of whipped cream. I think, that's amazing. This is not that kind of amazing. This is the amazing where you see something so horrific you can't even believe you're seeing it. And there's not a really good way to explain that in English. And John is so amazed, and here's what he's amazed about. This is 17 still. He's amazed that what him and the 12 disciples started doing after Jesus arose was to go out and evangelize the world. And they were getting them saved by the hundreds. By the thousands they were evangelizing. People were changing and giving their lives to Jesus, and he was part of that. Him and Mary traveled to Ephesus. He traveled with Jesus' mother, and they evangelized, and people flocked to them by the thousands. They were raising people from the dead. They were seeing miracles, and people were changing their lives. Jews were converting. Gentiles were coming in. And John saw it, and he is amazed that in his 96-year-old body, as he's seeing this apocalyptic vision, that in those 2,000 years, this is what the church looks like. Can you imagine what he thought? We're going to take a real good look at that cup tonight. The cup that she's drinking, the abomination that is the blood of the saints. It's not only that she's not telling the truth, she's killing people in the name of Jesus. Do you want to know why he's so shocked? That I'm sure he's standing there and thinking, oh my God, how did we come to this? And I want to tell you, when I turn on the news and I see on my TV and I turn on my computer and a screen comes up that I didn't ask for and a guy is getting ready to be beheaded on my computer, I have to click it off fast so I don't see it. I'm thinking, oh my God, how did we come to this? And remember going back to Revelation 10 where John says, prophesy again. This is what he's doing to us. He's saying to us, because he knew we'd read this, look what it's going to look like. And aren't we all ready? Because God does nothing but what he tells the prophets first. Aren't we already getting a glimpse of how this is going to look? Aren't we? Aren't we, as we turn on the news, seeing Revelation 17, aren't we? Aren't we seeing churches sold out to the world and talking about all the money they're bringing in and wearing their fancy clothes and going to the services in their golden robes and their scarlet and purple and being decked and adorned with jewels and pearls? Aren't we already seeing that? Don't we see it every day in the churches in America? Don't we? John says, this is Mystery Babylon. And Jesus has come out of her. Not my words. I know this is a hard lesson. I'm telling you, hang in with me. I promise next week's going to be better. But we have to know this. And Jeremiah 51 was part of the reading assignment I gave you a couple of weeks ago. You're going to see in Jeremiah the same story. We're not going to reread it. I want you to note that that's something you should have already read. But I want you to also know that Babylon is several things. When I told you I believe it literally, I believe it's deeper, and I believe it's deeper and deeper. I know it's a real place because in 1 Peter 5:13, Peter went to Babylon. He says it, he records it, and he writes about it. Some people will tell you, this is the allegory, people, that this is a code word for Rome. No, I don't think so. Babylon was a real city then. It actually still is kind of a city now. It's if you were to look up Babylon, now in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, and those of you that did the Daniel study with me will remember that that was the glory days for Babylon. He built his wife a hanging gardens, which was one of the ancient seven wonders of the world. She was not from there. She was from Mede, for she was a Mede, and missed the greenery. Now Babylon's in the desert. Shinar, the levels of Shinar. And so he built her this fantastic and engineering feat that no one can seem to figure out how he did, where gardens hung. It was actually one of the seven ancient wonders. This was in its glory days. It's not that now. It's a village, if it's anything. Jeremiah and Isaiah say it will be destroyed in one day. It's not done that yet. We think she's going to play into this. Do I think Babylon's a real place? Yes. Do I think that particular area of Shinar plays into this? Yes, I do. Do I think Peter in 1 Peter wrote Babylon and meant Rome? No, I think he meant Babylon. So let's get it straight. I think Babylon's a real place. I think the religion that came out of Babylon that we talked about last week that started, and I'm not going to do this again, just a brief review of the religion that started the Tower of Babel, which is in the plains of Shinar, which is today's Babylon, Iraq, let's put it in the right perspective, started with Nimrod. Nimrod and his wife Semiramis, went through all the history of who they really were, and when God confounded the language and spread people, they took those same two gods, goddesses, and they became Apollo, and they became Diana, and they became different names of the same gods and goddesses, and they were the god of the moon and stars. Allah is the God of the moon and stars. Let's take it full circle.
Do we know a big religion that worships the God of the moon and stars? We sure do. Do we see Mystery Babylon written on this whore? Do we see the Islamic religion part of this? Absolutely we do. But here's what happened that no one understands in history. When Nebuchadnezzar died and his grandson, that creepy Belshazzar, drank out of the golden cup, and you know the story, and God got mad and wrote fingers on the wall and killed him off right in his spot. In comes Cyrus the Great and Darius, and they're the Medes, and they take over. And we know this story from Daniel. The Medes and Persians had their run. We know that. Then after them, of course, Alexander the Great comes in. We know this is historical. This is biblical, but it's also historical. It's easily proven. And what we know from this then, when Alexander came in, he tried to take on, they were all practicing the Babylonian religion. Even the Medes and Persians did that. What happened, though, is after Alexander died and his four generals took over, it all kind of fell apart gracefully, if you could say that. So that Babylonian religion moved to Pergamos. Now, I want to remind you back to the second chapter of Revelation where Jesus is writing letters to the churches, and one of them is Pergamos. And he says the seat of Satan is there. Remember that, because I'm going to tell you this. That's a clue for us. Here's what we know. We know in the end times that the Antichrist is going to have a seat. Could it be Pergamos? Maybe. And let me pull this around full circle more. That's the Babylonian mystic religion we're talking about. When Pergamos kind of declined, guess who came in and took that mystical Babylonian religion over? Rome. Rome took on all the priests, and the hierarchy of that Pergamos Babylonian mystic Babylon religion, and it moved right into Rome to the first pope. Do you want to know why we celebrate Lent? We went over this a little bit last week, because that's the Babylonian religion lamenting over the death of Tammuz, which was Semiramis' son. And they mourned 40 days because he was killed by a boar. And at the end of 40 days of fasting, they celebrate with a celebration of ham. We know these mystical things from the Babylonian religion moved to Rome. We can trace them. Babylon, Pergamos, Rome. It's historical. It's not even, if you don't even believe the Bible, I can show you history how it happened. So why does the modern papal church have all of these things that people go, why do you do a rosary? Why? It's Babylonian. We can find the roots of that. Yes, we can find the roots of things that we do too. I'm pointing fingers back at us. I don't say Easter anymore. This is the word Ishtar, which is another name for Semiramis. Nimrod's wife. I'm not ever going to say Happy Easter again. That's Happy Semiramis. No. I'm going to say Happy Resurrection Day, because that's really what we're celebrating. You can do what you want to about it. Christmas, same way. Christmas was a pagan celebration with the Yule log, and there's wassail and different things, but am I going to give up Christmas? No, because I'm going to celebrate Jesus' birth. And I might just say, Happy Jesus, Happy Birthday, Jesus. I may say that. Although the word Christmas was not Babylonian. It was Roman. I'm just trying to say to you, we have to look at what God's saying about this mystery religion that we're seeing in front of us. It's in front of our eyes every day. We see the spectacular mammoth choirs that come on TV with the sound equipment that are golden and bands and singers that should be on Hollywood stage, and we are way entertained. You can step into some of those churches and think, whoa. Do you think God was there? Probably not. How do I know that? I look at the New Testament church. I don't have any other examples of the Bible. And so I think, are we being with the robes? Are we being robish and silverish and goldish and pearlish and jewelish? Are we? I don't know. When I'm criticizing, my thumb points back at myself. Have I put too much emphasis on the worldly pleasures of worship and sitting in a nice... I don't know. Have I? And I go before God and ask. But here's what I do know. He says, this is who's left. This is the church. It so astonished John that he was almost sick when he saw it. The angel had to come and settle him again, because this was so disturbing that this is what the Lord that died for him, this is what his story looks like 2,000 years later. And how many of us think maybe this is what the story looks like for Jesus? We went into Psalm 22 a little bit, and that is the Psalm of the Cross. You should know it by now. It is where Jesus calls himself a worm. And we did understand that the caucus worm was where they get the red dye from. And Olita did some real unique studies on that. I just thought that was such an interesting thing, that Jesus doesn't say something except for a reason. He says, I am a worm, referring back to the red dye that looks like the blood, and it take it full circle that this gaudy, God-awful whore is wearing this color. The color of the blood that he shed, and how dare she do that? How dare she do that? Because she's Mystery Babylon. And she says, I'm a queen. I am no widow, and I sit a queen. That's what she calls herself. Now, I want you to know that sanguinarians are people that are blood drinkers. And unless you think that's only in vampire stories and movies, it's a true story. If you don't know who they are, you need to think about it. They're in the Bible. This is a very good example of a sanguinarian. You are seeing Mystery Babylon. She is drunk with the blood of the saints. If you do any study on this, because I kind of blew that off at first. Oh, shit. I believe it's literal. I believe that these religions drink blood. And if you want to do a really scary research, look it up. They're secret. It's behind closed doors. Many of these are practicing blood drinking. You think I'm kidding? Look it up. John saw it and was so upset he couldn't believe it. And here's what else it means. Not only are they drinking blood of humans, they are sacrificing human beings. Look it up. There are churches doing this behind closed doors. Churches that we accept in this country today. And there are people that are calling themselves vampires, because what happens with this, it's a physiological thing. I'm not a doctor. I wish Tristan was here because it would help. The copper in the blood does something. It changes chemicals. And I want you to know, if you don't think your DNA can be changed by doing stuff, look it up. You can change your DNA by exercise, by the way your diet is. This is on this edge of DNA changing. On the edge. Look it up. It's sanguinarians. You are taking a look at why witches, why pagans, why Babylonian religions all worship the blood. Jesus said the life is in the blood. He knew it. He said, I shed my blood for you as a remission for sin. He couldn't do anything else to save us but shed his blood. It is so powerful that even the mystical religions are trying to do that. You're seeing that in this woman, in this religion. Do I think in the end times, do I think in the tribulation that this Babylonian mystery church is going to drink the blood of saints? You bet I do. I think they're going to cut their heads off, and I think they're going to drink their blood. I think we're seeing it, and I think John is so astonished he can't stand up. And this is in the name of Christianity. Shame on them. The fall of Babylon's announced twice. We studied that a little bit. It's important. Anytime something is done twice, it's important. I want to remind you that at the fifth trumpet, let's step back a little bit, see if your revelation mind remembers this. At the fifth trumpet, Satan opens the abyss and lets the demonic spirits out of the earth. Do you remember that? So what happened with that fifth trumpet? Now, we've way past that. We've gone the seven trumpets. We're past that. We're past the bowls. But about halfway through, when that fifth trumpet is opened and all this stuff comes out of the abyss, that's when the demonic things come. This woman is riding the beast with the 10 horns. Who I truly believe are 10 demonic kings. I think we saw them in Daniel when Daniel was praying, and Gabriel was held up 21 days by the prince of Persia. He wasn't held up by a prince. He was held up by a demon. A demon king, a demon prince. I think we're seeing that here. It was opened in the fifth trumpet. This is not news to us. It's just, this is review. This is getting us up to the 18th chapter. These are things I wanted to touch base with you so that as we go to the 18th, you remember these. They're going to refer to a great city in chapter 18. And what I'm going to say to you is this. Lots of speculation about that. You're going to hear everything from Jerusalem to New York to Taiwan. And we're going to do a little study on, I'm going to let you come to your own conclusion about that. I think the Bible makes it pretty clear. But I'm going to tell you, there, you'll listen to 10 pastors on that and you'll hear 5 different ideas. It's not specific. We just have to dig. I want to also remind you that in Job 1:6, when Satan went before God to plead against Job, he was still having access to heaven. We saw later in Revelation he's kicked out. He no longer, in this picture of John, in this part of Revelation, Satan's kicked out of heaven. He is totally on the earth. Okay, so remember that. And I want you to do a pre-look with me, just thinking for a minute, of what this could be. And then we're going to do, this is just a pre-look, may or may not be true. If Mystery Babylon is Babylon, remember I told you it really is a real city. It's right now, if you were to look, it's like a village. However, Saddam Hussein believed that he was the Nebuchadnezzar reincarnated. Did you know that? And began pouring millions of dollars into it. Several building projects got done. And then we all know his untimely demise person that he was. So it's not a metropolis now. If Babylon is to be this big city at the end that we're going to see in chapter 18, there's going to be after a lot of building going on. Don't let that stop you from thinking it could be, because the Chinese boast now that they can put up a skyscraper in 2 months. Maybe they can, I don't know. We do know that Dubai was built, what, in 2 years? And don't let the fact that it's not a metropolis now stop you from thinking. Most of us believe Babylon is Rome, and that it may or may not be. So I'm just telling you that the two main theories that we're going to see for this chapter 18 that we're looking at, the city and the political system, most scholars are going to fall on the side of it's really bad, it's really going to be Babylon rebuilt, or it's Rome. So we'll see what you think. And that takes us into chapter 18. And 18 is going to look like this. Let's go back and talk about what we should see in chapter 18. 18 is going to look like this. We've seen this woman riding the beast. She was the religious system. The beast, of course, you know, is the Antichrist who has the 10 kings that are demonic and all that. We know that. We're going to see the rest of Babylon the Great, and it's going to be the political system. What we are going to see is, let's think about the tribulation period. We start the tribulation period, and that harlot woman comes right into being. Think about, the church gets raptured. These pastors that lied to their people or missed it are going to come up full throttle. These priests that lied to their parishes are going to say, oh, that was a fake or something. They're going to come up and they're going to start worshiping the beast. That's going to be the first part of the tribulation. So that chapter 17, that religious system, is the first part of the tribulation. At midterm, and we know this story from Daniel, something happens at midterm, how we know it. It's called the abomination of desolation, where the Antichrist, yeah, she's been riding on his back for 3.5 years, and he's tired of her getting worshipped. We're going to go back and read the end of 17 to see what they do again. It says they eat her, they devour her, and they destroy her with fire. That religious system, that church, those people in the big robes and the jewelry and the pearls and the big scarlet and purple, they get destroyed by the Antichrist at midway point, because he goes into the temple, he sets himself up, and the Holy of Holies, and declares himself God. And at that point, he destroys all other religions, and the false prophet comes up and begins telling people, you must take the mark. We are now on chapter 18 at the midpoint of the tribulation. Now remember, this is not in time sequence. We've already studied this. This is the little snapshot. I like to say John writes, well, he's an apocalyptic writer, of course, because he writes about the future. And he's an epistle writer because he writes letters. But he's a snapshot writer. Because what he does is he tells you a little bit and goes, oh, wait a minute, I need to give you a close-up. So he takes his lens out and he clips that lens in and you get it magnified. We've already studied the first part of the tribulation, but he wants to magnify what the church looked like in that first 3.5 years. They looked pretty ratty. They were drinking the blood of saints. They were living it high. But at the halfway point, he says, she gets eaten and fired up and dies. The church does. Because now the Antichrist has set himself up as Lord and King, and you will take the mark or you get your head cut off. He's giving us a picture of what that looks like. And we're going to see in chapter 18 the rest of the story about that time, about what the commerce looked like at that time. Because that's all interwoven with taking the mark. If you don't take the mark of the beast, you can't sell, you can't buy, you can't have a business, you can't eat, you can't do groceries, you can't do anything. And we're going to take a look at what that looks like in chapter 18. We're going to look at the commerce and political system. Because by this point, the religious system is destroyed. Okay? Hope I made that clear. Let's start at in Revelation 18. I'm just going to start at the very first verse. Okay? After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. This gives you that he's a very important angel. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. Lots in that. I'm going to take you back to Genesis 41:32. Let's go back to the very first book in the Bible. Genesis 41:32. And I want to tell you what a double meaning means. Because a Bible doesn't make any mistakes. He said, Babylon is fallen. And last time I checked, that's twice he said it. Here's what it means. Genesis 41:32. I'm going to remind you of this story. Pharaoh had a dream, very disturbed by it. And Joseph, who had been taken captive, sold out by his brothers, got called in as a slave to interpret this dream. And here it is, Genesis 41:32. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. Joseph explained this concept to the Pharaoh when he explained his dream. In other words, Joseph said, you saw it twice because God's establishing a truth with you. So what we already know from Genesis, that's God's rules. If he says it twice, it's a truth. And we hear Babylon is fallen. And we know from Genesis what that means. We hear also, this is a very interesting reference to me, when it says, they're talking about Babylon fallen, a dwelling place of demons, we know what that means. A prison for every foul spirit, we know what that means. But listen to this, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. I had to look that up. Matthew 13 goes back, let's talk about who Matthew was. Remember, Matthew was the tariff collector, the person who took the very best and most meticulous notes, because he's the only one of the apostles we know for sure that took shorthand. Had to for his job. So when you read Matthew, you're going to get every detail there is. I love it. And in his 13th chapter, starting about the third verse, I'm going to pick a few verses out of Matthew 13. I'm going to remind you of the parable story of the sower of the wheat, because we want to know what these unclean birds were. Okay, Matthew 13, I'm starting with the third verse. Then he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, behold, a sower went out to sow, and he sowed some seed, and it fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured it. Okay, that's interesting. Now skip on to the 18th verse. Therefore, hear the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, then the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. It already tells you, points back, the wicked one was the birds. Did you know that? Did you know that in the Bible, when it refers to birds, it's always in a negative import? Did you know that? That when he's talking about birds, it's not a good thing. Because he said here, it's the wicked one comes. So let's go back to Revelation and read that again. And I'm at the very last of the second verse. It's talking about Babylon. It has become an a cage for every unclean and hated bird. These are things of the devil. These are the wicked ones. How do I know that? Matthew explained it to us. So let's take a look. Babylon has fallen, it's fallen. It's established, used twice. And God says, not only has it fallen from its first glory, it's full of demons, foul spirits, and devils. That's what it's saying there. Wouldn't want to go there, would you? Ew. All right. Let's continue on reading, and we are now in Revelation, the third verse. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornications. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich with the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. At reach to heaven, it stuck out at me. I like to go back. Let's go back to Psalm. Let's go back to Psalms 57. God just doesn't make any mistakes in his words. And I know you probably get tired of me saying that. But I think we, as Americans in our hurry, scurry world, get so accustomed to skimming. I'm a skim reader. I can read a 700-page book in one night. I can skim it. I can pretty much tell you all the main things of it. And so if I don't like it very well, I'll just skim it over and have it done one night. Now, if I really like it, I morsel it up and enjoy the juiciness. But I can't do that with this kind of stuff. I have for years skimmed. I'm a fast reader, and that's to my detriment. And so what I have learned in this study is I don't want to miss one word. So I'm trying to focus you on, for her sins have reached to the heavens. So let's read Psalm 57:10. And I want you to know that I do this for me more than any. You, maybe you're not like me and skim over stuff, but I'm in Psalm 57, verse 10. For your mercy reaches unto the heavens, and your truth unto the clouds. So there it's, his mercy's reaching into the heavens. Let's go to Psalm 36. God, David's talking about God's mercy reaching to the heavens. I love that. I love that part. And we're in Psalm 36, verse 5. Now remember, King David wrote 500 years before John saw this. Your mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the clouds. You're getting the picture of God's mercy. Let's do one more Psalm. 103:11. I call this thumb practice. You have to thumb back and forth. My thumb's gotten bigger and bigger over this study. So it's all good. Psalm 103:11. For as the heavens are high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward those who fear him. There's the key. How high is his mercy? To the heavens. Who's it for? Those who fear him. Who is this talking about? We're talking about Babylon has fallen, is the haunt of all the unclean spirits. It's the evil birds, the wicked things. And here's how John says it. And John says in verse 4, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to the heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. David said he forgets my iniquities. But here's the difference. what we read in Psalms. His mercy reaches to the heavens to those who what? Fear him. These people don't fear him. There's no mercy for them. Mercy in chapter 18, mercy's over. And if I didn't prove that to you by those three Psalms, there's probably 57 more that'll prove it to you. This is saying that little section, for sins have reached to heaven and God has remembered her iniquities, is the one thing you should underline. Mercy is over. Because they didn't fear him. That's what David said. David said it 600 years before this. Don't you love it? Don't you love that God just doesn't miss a trick? The wine of the wrath of her fornication, we've talked about God's wrath before. That's been a difficult study for us this whole time. We've talked about it in Revelation 14. And we talked about it in Jeremiah 25 and in Isaiah 51. I'm not going to go back and do the study about God's wrath. It is in your notes, and there's lots to it. I want you to know that those of you that have friends that say to you that God is a God of love and mercy and kindness and goodness, and I say, yes, he is. And I want to say the rest of the story is also righteous. And because he's righteous, we see Revelation 18 because of the righteousness of God. I am now in verse 6. I wanted to talk one more thing. No, we'll save that for just a little bit. Render to her, I'm going to go ahead and start with this. Render to her just as she rendered to you, and repay her double. There's that double again. Remember, I proved to you in Genesis that when it's talking about double, it means it's a done deal. Double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed double. There's that double reference again for her. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure given her torment and sorrow, for she says in her heart, I sit a queen and am no widow and will not see sorrow. Now this is interesting to me, that she is bragging on herself. She being this political system, now we're seeing the part of Babylon that is the political. The religious system has been destroyed. Now we're seeing the political, financial system. Let's get a picture of this. When the rapture happens, the nearest I can imagine it to be, and I'm so not good with this, I can't imagine that America would be standing, that the European network would be standing. I really think when the rapture happens and the amount of people are taken that are going to be taken out, I think there's going to be a worldwide collapse. That's what I think. Now, that's a Lindaism. It seems to me that one world government thing and that one world political system and that one world religion would all just come in and fill up that gap. Suck in that vacuum. That's what it seems like to me. I think what we're seeing here is that's what's happened in chapter 18. We're seeing that she got rich and luxurious and glorious, and but God's saying, I'm going to torment you, I'm going to measure out to you exactly what you did. And I think that's what we're beginning to see. God is, the justice and the righteousness of God is never seen in such a fury as we see in Revelation, because it's the end of the story. He's got to finish everything up. The I said a queen, am no widow, and will not see sorrow is a direct reference back to the woman we saw with the sun and moon and stars, and she was by herself. She was a widow. She was pregnant. This is the system saying, I'm not Israel. This is a direct reference against Israel. This system, this world system, is going to be the most anti-Semitic, the most anti-Jew, the most anti-Christian thing you could even hope to imagine. I can't even picture it. Because with the beheadings we're seeing now, think about that on a global scale of every Jew they could find, every Christian they could find. I mean, we're talking millions. That's what you're going to be seeing with this system. And they're bragging about it. I'm not a widow. I'm not. I'm a queen. And it goes back to when we talked about the Babylonian system having the queen of heaven as one of their gods they worship. It fits with all that. So that's what we're seeing there. Isaiah 47, if you're interested in this, we're not going to take time to read it because I know we're going to get late tonight, but I'm going to give you a reference you might want. And it's the one about the widow. Isaiah 47, 8 refers to Israel not being a widow. And so pull that in. Again, we saw the doubles. I want to read you something interesting from Jeremiah, because I believe Jeremiah saw this same picture just like John did. So let's pull Jeremiah 3, the 6th verse. Jeremiah 3, verse 6. The Lord said also to me in the days of Josiah the king, have you seen what backsliding Israel has done? She has gone up on every high mountain and under every green tree, and there played the harlot. And I said, after she had done all these things, return to me. But she did not return, and her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw that for all the causes for which backsliding Israel had committed adultery, I had put her away and given her her certificate of divorce. God divorces Israel in Old Testament times, but he takes her back. I want to read on in Jeremiah 3:14. Return, and here's what he says. This is the mercy of God that Jeremiah is seeing for Israel. Return, O backsliding children, says the Lord, for I am married to you. I will take you, one from a city, two from a family, and I will bring you to Zion. So we see first he says, I'm divorcing you for all your fornication. And then in Jeremiah 3:14 he says, but I am married to you. Those people that think God has deserted Israel, they don't know the Old Testament. He's mad as thunder at her. He is so mad he wants to throttle her, and he does. But he loves her, and he's a God of his word. And in Jeremiah 3:14, he said, for I am married to you. That's God married to Israel. If you don't know that verse, underline that. Because you will have people telling you, well, I'm sorry, the church has replaced Israel. And we are now here. No, 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 no. Do you not understand the prophet Jeremiah? Not read that story? Give him Jeremiah 3:14. And I want to remind you back in Revelation 12, this was this is the contrast of that woman that we saw, where we saw the great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed, and that was Israel. We see her. She is contrasted throughout this whole chapter in 17. At the beginning of 17, I gave you a chart, and I said, contrast the two women. One's a whore. One's a widow, one has a baby, one is sucking the blood of babies. I mean, there was quite a contrast. The woman in chapter 12 is Israel. It's God's beloved. And he's mad at her a lot of the Old Testament, but he never forsakes her. And this tribulation, the happening of the tribulation happens to bring Israel back to him. That's why we're doing Revelation. So there's a direct contrast between those two, tale of two women. In Isaiah 47:9, let's just refer to that real fast. Isaiah saw this same story. We are going to do a real in-depth study of Isaiah, and you're going to think, oh my gosh, are we reading Revelation? Yeah, you really are. These guys all saw the same story. God didn't change his story. If it's a true story, you can tell it over and over. It never changes. That's the way this is. Isaiah 47:9 says, both of these will overtake you in a moment, on a single day. We're going to find out that Babylon is destroyed in a single day, and Isaiah saw it in Isaiah 47:9 again. Both of these will overtake you in a moment, on a single day. Loss of children and widowhood, they will come upon you in full measure, in spite of your many sorceries and your potent spells. We did a study on sorcery last time. It's a downfall of Babylon. The root word is pharmakeia. Pharmacy. Drugs. We're going to see drugs prevalent in the tribulation. It's one of the tricks of Satan to drug the people. Been using it since day one. So, if you want to compare
sorcery of Revelation 18:23, which we're going to come to in a little bit, compare it to Isaiah 47:9, because that you're going to see the exact same reference. Isaiah 47:9, sorceries. Revelation 18:23, sorceries. You don't think so?
I got it.
Did we get it?
Yeah.
It's the same root word, sorcery. Okay. Now I'm going to continue on in the 8th verse of the chapter, Revelation 18. I know I've taken to you a lot of different chapters, but now we're back in Revelation 18. I'm in the 8th verse. Therefore, her plagues will come in one day. Notice that one day. We're going to talk about that. Death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for the strong is the Lord God who judges her. Goes back to God's judgment, goes back to his wrath. He mentions three plagues in that. He says death is going to happen, mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, and famine. And he brings in fire, and if you know anything about the studies we've done about God is a God of fire, and he uses it, and Jesus always has burnished fiery feet. This is who God is. When you see fire, it is God Almighty. Get back. Verse 9. The kings of earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burnings, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." Now, I had to do this. This is the word search that I couldn't leave alone. And I had to figure out what 1 hour meant. Because if you know God, he doesn't mess with details unless it's really important. Let's go back to Matthew, our tax collector, tariff operator. And I want you to turn to the 26th chapter of Matthew. Matthew, I find when I need real details, he usually comes through for me. When I meet him in heaven, I'm going to say, "Thank you for taking such good notes." Because people like me that want to have these curious questions, Matthew usually comes up with it. So I'm in Matthew 26. I'm in verse 38. I want to remind you that this is a tough time for Jesus. Jesus is getting ready to be crucified. And he knows it. And I'm in the 38th verse of the 26th chapter of Matthew. Then he said to them, to his disciples, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here with me and watch." They're in the Garden of Gethsemane. He went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not I will, but as you will." And I don't know if you ever noticed this before. The cup Jesus is talking about is the blood he has to shed. This sorceress whore is drinking the blood of saints. Jesus is going to shed the blood of the cup. You see the difference? It's always the devil trying to mimic Jesus. Jesus calls it a cup. "I don't want to do this." The humanness of him was scared. That's not a sin. Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "What? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Let's go back. 1 hour for God is a important time period. We flip that off and say, "Oh, well, 1 hour. Why can't you watch with me 1 hour? What Jesus is really saying to them, this is the hour before I'm going to enter to my end times. I think the fact that the hour here represents a powerful, it's one of those things, I think it extends beyond 24 hours. In the dimensional world that Jesus was in, hours meant something different. And I think, I'm not explaining this very well, but I think what God was saying is this hour is so important. It's like, put your magnifying glass on this.
Look at this hour Jesus spent with the Lord. Look what he did. He prayed for us. We've done that, John 17. He prayed for help. He prayed for his disciples. The disciples fell asleep 2 or 3 times. He talks to God. An angel comes in ministry. This is a huge hour of time. I'm not so sure it wasn't expanded. That's what I'm saying. And when we see this Babylon destroyed, it's destroyed in 1 hour. Yes, I think it was an hour. Yes, I do. I think it's literal. But I think it's more dimensional than that. I think God's saying that hour that my son labored over this great sacrifice is how long I'm going to destroy you. With this hour of destruction, this pretty much ends it all. This is pretty much end of the story. He destroys the political, the economic system in this hour. Am I starting to make a little importance here about how important I think that hour is? It may be way more than an hour in dimensional times. It may be spiritually so much more than we can see. He's destroying Babylon to the ground. He's destroying the last hurrah of Satan. He's already destroyed the religious. He's now saying, I'm taking it all. Jesus gave it all. I'm taking it all back. I think there's a correlation there. Maybe you can see that. I think there's a really strange reference that happens in Revelation 17 that we talked a little bit about last week. Let's pull back that, because I want to pick that up, because it's the same Greek word, and it's Revelation 17, verse 12. I want to show you how I think this hour means more. It means an hour, but it means more in dimensions. Let's read Revelation 17, 12. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. Remember, I told you I think they're demonic. Who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings and beasts. I think this is a spiritually dimension. Now, you know I don't believe that it's... Yes, I believe it's 24 hours. Yes, I do. But I believe it's... In the spiritual realm, I think there's a lot of things happen in that time. Just like in that hour that Jesus was praying at Gethsemane, he says to Peter, can't you stay awake for 1 hour? It isn't the 60 minutes that he's worrying about. It's in that dimensional time. Wouldn't it have been nice for Peter to have been over there laying hands on him, praying with him? Where were those guys? Why weren't they surrounding him and praying for him? Yes, God sent an angel to minister to him, but where were these guys? And I think Jesus said, don't you understand, in this hour rides all of eternity. I could have said no to doing this. I could have said no to the cross in this hour. I could have. And God would have said, come on home. And in this hour, eternity changed. In this hour where these kings in 17 get authority, something changes dimensionally. And I think that's what happens when Babylon is destroyed. Yes, I think it's destroyed in 1 hour. But I think there are so much interdimensional things happening. I think demons are destroyed and spirits and Nephilim. And I think that's a huge hour. And I think there's no reason that God would have used that same term for what Jesus did praying in that hour and this. These are really important hours. And that's the best way I can say it. Look at that differently, because I think that's hugely important. And I am in verse 11. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble, and cinnamon, and incense, fragrant oil, and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and the bodies and souls of men. If you didn't count, there's 28 items. Why you say 28? Just in case you wondered. Let me tell you how important 28 is to God. It's 7 times 4. 7 is the perfect number of God. 4 is a very awful number for God. It's the Trinity plus 1, which is what Satan always wanted to be. Satan always wanted to be number 4. Really wanted to be number 1. but he wanted to be right up there with the Trinity. So four is not a good number for God. So if you've got the perfect number four times, it screws everything up. Now listen to this, and just this is a point of interest I think you might like to know. According to history, this is according to Josephus, 28 armed soldiers accompanied Jesus as he carried the cross. 7 times 4, 28. And there were 28 signs of the cross that the priest does in mass, completing the apostasy. 28. God doesn't miss a number. 28 is not a holy number for God. It's opposite of holy. It's apostasy. There's something that I think people read over, and we need to understand this last part. And I'm in the last phrase of verse 13. It says, and bodies and souls of men. Well, why, you ask, would they say that? Now, the modern theologians say this, that they will be dealing in slave trade. I believe they will be. I think they're doing it now. I think the Catholic Church is dealing in slave trade right now. You didn't hear me say that, did you? I think a lot of religious groups are dealing in slave trade in one way or the other. Yes, it does mean that, but it means more than that. And for instance, let's go to Ezekiel, who might shed some insight on what this means. I am in Ezekiel 13. Wait, before I do that, I want to go to Joel, because he's a little bit better, and then we'll go back to, sorry about that. Let's go to Joel 3. Now remember I told you Joel, Ezekiel, Isaiah, we can pull in Jeremiah. All these guys saw the same story, so we get a little bit different mix from each one of them, but Joel has a little bit better picture of it. Joel 3, I'm in the third verse of Joel 3. And he's seeing this same story. He doesn't understand what he sees, because think where he is. You know, he's six centuries beyond this. They have cast lots for my people, have given a boy as payment for a harlot, and sold a girl for wine that they may drink. Indeed, what have you to do with me, O Tyre and Sidon and all the coast of Philistia? Will you retaliate against me? But if you retaliate against me swiftly and speedily, I will return your retaliation upon your own head. Because you have taken my silver and my gold. Does this sound anything like silver and gold of the... Yeah, Babylon, I think so. Because you have taken my silver and my gold and have carried into your temples my prized possessions. Also the people of Judah and the people of Jerusalem, you have sold to the Greeks. This is talking about slavery. That you may remove them from far from their borders. Behold, I will raise them out of the place to which you have sold them. And will return your retaliation upon your own head. Joel saw all of Israel being moved around and sold and all, and he says this, I will sell your sons and your daughters into the hands of the people of Judah. He's turning it back on them, and they will sell them to the Sabians, to a people far off, for the Lord has spoken. He's saying, what you have done to my people, I'm going to do to you. And he says that right there in Joel, where he saw this same picture of this slave trading. And he's saying, because you traded all of my people, and they're still doing it here, he said, at the very end, I'm going to bring my people back. This is Israel's promise in Joel to get to come back to their homeland. It's everything that we want to know when we say that we believe God has not forsaken the Israelites. Let's turn to Ezekiel now. I want to go to the 13th chapter of Ezekiel. This is more thumb practice for you. Sorry, but we got to get the whole story. And that's about Revelation. You can't get the whole story unless you know it all. And I am in the 13th chapter, and I am in the 19th verse. And will you profane me among my people for handfuls of barley and for pieces of bread, killing people who should not die and keeping people alive who should not live by your lying to my people who listen to lies? Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against your magic charms by which you hunt souls there like birds. Remember birds. I will tear them from your arms and let the souls go, the souls you hunt like birds. You want to know how creepy this is? Ezekiel sees what's happening in Babylon. These people are practicing black magic and witchcraft. This is what Ezekiel sees. Birds, remember what I told you about birds? They're wicked. They are trying to steal the souls of people, and they're doing it by lying to him. They're taking the mark of the beast. Then they're killing them. And there's something even more devilish going on. And if I could explain it to you the best I could, I think we're getting into the Nephilim realm. And why do I think that? Nephilim beings don't have souls. They're not redeemable. And I think Ezekiel sees it, and I think John sees the trading of bodies and souls. I think they're making Nephilim. I think they're trading them. I think they're raising up these crazy soldiers they're making out of DNA. I think, you know, I think John doesn't know how to explain it except they're trading bodies and souls. Ezekiel says, why are you hunting souls? And will you hunt the souls of my people and keep yourselves alive, and you're keeping people alive that shouldn't be, and you're making people dead that shouldn't be? And I think he's seeing this and not quite understanding what he's seeing. And I don't think we are going to understand this except in the realm of the Nephilim. I think what we're seeing in this verse is John trying to explain these people are dealing in souls and bodies. Nephilim don't have any souls. So they would only be dealing in bodies. That's the nearest I can come to explaining that. And when we talk about birds in Ezekiel, we're talking about wicked things. Does that make sense to anybody? Or is that too creepy to even get past you? It is creepy, guys, but I think this is one of the deceptions we're going to see in the very end times. You guys have questions about that? All right. Well, we'll go on then. the horses and chariots and bodies and souls of men. I'm in verse 14. The fruit that your soul longed for is gone from you, and all the things which were rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things who become rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing and saying, alas, alas, the great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour, there's that 1 hour again. That's a special time that I think is more than that. Such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, sailors, as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what is this great city? We're going to see several classes of people that mourn this. They're all merchants. Remember, we have finished with the religious system. We're looking now at the political, and we are looking at the social economic. It's destroyed. So why do the shipmasters mourn? Well, it's God's way of saying it's all the commerce. This is commerce. The merchants are angry. The shipmasters are angry because this great city, whether it's Rome, whether it's really the new Babylon that's revised, whichever it is, they were the center for the Antichrist. That was the center of commerce. It's destroyed in 1 hour, whatever that hour means. And now it's haunted by all these creepy things that are buying and selling souls. And I think they're making Nephilim in that city. And I think they're distributing them out across the world. And it's the merchants are going, oh, wow, we have no one to trade with. And they're lamenting and they're standing back. Let's note this. They're all standing back watching. There are many commentators that believe that the reason they're standing back and watching the smoke of torment, they think it's a nuclear weapon that happens. Now, it might be. Makes sense to me. They could destroy any city in 1 hour. Absolutely. Would there be a smoky torrent that came up? Sure, there would be. I don't know. God doesn't have to use nukes. God can just look down and zap it. I don't know how it is. We just know that it's destroyed. Fire comes out, smoke. Could it be a nuclear weapon and everyone's standing afar off looking? Could be. It's a modern interpretation of this. I don't know that for sure. You'll have to decide that for yourself. It does make sense. So every shipmaster who travels by ship, sailors, all those are looking on. Because they are the third group of onlookers, and they stand far off. We don't know why. Probably to save their own biscuits is probably why. Because that would be awful to see that. I don't know. It does make sense that it could be a nuclear weapon, but it doesn't have to be. So we've gone through the destruction of this great city. And we're looking now at 19. They threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing and saying, "Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour," there it is again, "she was made desolate." I want to point out to the dust on their heads. There is only one religion now in modern day times that when they're lamenting throws dust on their heads. Do you know what it is? It's Islamic. It's the Arabs. The Islamic nation throws dust on their heads. Modern researchers believe that's why they think that this city is probably really Babylon, really in the plains of Shinar, because the onlookers that are close, standing there, looking, seem to be Muslim. They're throwing dust on their heads. It's the only religion that does that. Just a point. And I can't prove that. I'm just saying now that's what it seems like. So consider that and see what you find out. "Rejoice over her, O heaven, you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her." Finally, the saints under the altar that we saw early on in Revelation, we said, "When, God, are you going to avenge us?" Here's what he says. Here's his answer in Revelation 18:20. "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her." Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone. By the way, in Revelation, just for your, I'm curious about words. There are three times in the book of Revelation he uses the term mighty angel. You're going to see it first in Revelation 5:2. And then you're going to see that term again in Revelation 10:1. And you know how the Trinity is. Number 3 finishes it up in Revelation 18:21. Just, if you're curious like me, this is the third time. Third is the Trinity. "Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, 'Thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore. The sound of harpists, musicians, flautists, trumpeters shall not be heard in you anymore. No craftsman of any craft shall be found in you anymore. And the sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you anymore. The light of a lamp shall not shine in you anymore. And the voice of the bridegroom and bride shall not be heard in you anymore. For your merchants were the great men of the earth. For by your sorcery," here we go again, "all the nations were deceived. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and saints, and of all who were slain on the earth." Now let me stop here a minute and interject something that I think is pretty phenomenal. A millstone is two round stones. When they're grinding together, you put the wheat in between, and it grinds wheat into flour. Many of us aren't used to knowing that because we go to the grocery store and buy a sack. I have to look these things up because I don't know it either. The Bible's pretty interesting when it uses the word millstone. Interesting to me that he ends up Babylon, finishes it up with the third Trinity, mighty angel, throwing a millstone and finishing her up. It's interesting because, let's for instance look what the New Testament says about that. Turn with me to Mark 9:42. And I'm sorry this lesson is so long, guys. Okay. I apologize. There's so much in this I don't want you to miss, and there's lots more you can research. But let's turn to Mark 9:42. "But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him
if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea. Let's see what Matthew has to say about it. Matthew 18:5. And you gotta love the Gospels. You gotta love the Gospels. Matthew 18, verse 5. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. So if you put that back to what Mark says, it's like they're rejecting Jesus. So go on, let's take it one step further to Luke 17:2. This is Dr. Luke, who's also kind of a nitpicker. You gotta love Dr. Luke. It would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea, that he should offend one of these little ones. Take heed to yourselves. What they're saying is this. Jesus said it. They're repeating Jesus' words. You cause one person, one child, one infant baby Christian, one new person in the faith, one innocent to fall. You cause one of them to. It's better that I tied a millstone on your neck and threw you in the deepest sea than to what is going to happen to you. And Jesus finally says this. I'm just going to throw a millstone at you. I think what happens is this. The final judgment then becomes for this blasphemous, unholy, ungodly political system that took so many little innocent non-believers to hell. What happens to them? Let's read it one more time. And we're back in the 18th chapter of Revelation. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore. You want to talk about millstones? That's your ultimate punishment. And this is God saying, stamp it, done. You have caused innocents to die. You have caused non-Christians that might have been saved. You've caused them to go to hell by your mark. I'm going to do the ultimate punishment for you. I am going to do exactly what Mark and Matthew and Luke warned you about. I'm going to tie a millstone on your neck and I'm going to throw you into the deepest part of the sea. And shame on every pastor, every, quote, laissez-faire Christian for leading anyone. This is going to be their ultimate outcome. It also says this. If you could talk about Mystery Babylon, if you could describe it in your own words, and you had to sum it up and not 2.5-3 hours like I've done, I could sum it up in one word, and that is doomed. Doomed. They're gone. Do they serve it? Yes. Is God just and right? Yes. Is there any hope for them? No. Is John amazed at what has happened to the church, to the earth? Yes. What do we learn from this? We know for a fact that in the Bible, Babylon, the word, is named over 300 times. How important is this to God? Here we go with the three. It's God's perfect word. 300 times God talks about Babylon. In 17 and 18, if I could sum this up for you, I'd say this. We're not going to be here, but we know people that are. Get off your couches and tell somebody to find out the truth, because here's what's going to happen. There is coming a great change. The rapture of the church is going to happen and everything else changes. There will be a one world government, there will be a one world political system, and there will be a one world religion. And it will all be headed by that beast that has 10 horns and that has been called the dragon, Satan of old, you name it. That wicked, the Antichrist. He's going to have the Antichrist and the false prophet at his side, and they're going to rule the world.
You take their mark, you're okay for about 3.5 years. You don't, you get your head cut off. What we're seeing is, this is the ending up, last part of the wrath. This is the end of the wrath. The millstone on Babylon is the last part of the wrath. And John's saying, as he sees this, doom, doom, doom. There is no hope. Is there hope for us? Absolutely. There is always hope for us because we have Jesus. First Peter, one of my buddies, because he made lots of mistakes, just like I do. I'm reading from 1 Peter 1, the 22nd verse. And this is to you guys. Since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit, in sincere love of the brethren, love one another fervently with a pure heart, having been born again. This is our charge. Not of corruptible seed, but incorruptible through the word of God, which lives and abides forever, which you're studying. This is your charge. Because all flesh is as grass, and all glory of man is a flower of grass. The grass withers and its flower falls away, but the word of the Lord endures forever. Now this is the word which by the gospel was preached to you. And this is Peter saying to you, you are going to die. May get raptured, but... And you're going to wither away, but God's word is going to stay true. And because you are pure of heart and you are born again, you have this. And this is your promise. And we don't have to fret, and we don't have to worry, and we don't have to be afraid. It's a scary kind of time, but I serve a really big God. And when I pray in the morning for you guys, and I do pray for you every morning, I pray this, that you would feel his love surround you in the promises that he gives. And that even the hard truths that we say make you more secure in who you are in him. Because even that 1 hour of destiny, I like to call it in Gethsemane, when we prayed that John 17 prayer for us, and when we see tonight that 1 hour even comes into this Babylon story, that in that 1 hour, he chose you. He chose you. And it just doesn't get any better than that. Anybody have any questions? Well, I will tell you this. Next week will be a breath of fresh air, if you like horses.